Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. El Salvador's ambassador to the United States is asking Congress to protect thousands of her citizens from deportation. Earlier this week, the Trump administration said it was ending a program for Salvadorans known as TPS, Temporary Protected Status. 200,000 Salvadorans were allowed to work and live in the United States under TPS after a pair of earthquakes devastated the country in 2001. They will now have to leave by September 2019 or risk deportation. Ambassador Claudia Yvette Canjura says she's turning to U.S. lawmakers for help.
There are five bills that have been introduced in the Congress, and all of those bills are looking for improving the status of our people.
Well, Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd spoke with the ambassador, and he joins us now. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Meghna.
So what else is the Salvadoran government saying about the ending of TPS for its citizens?
Well, look, they knew this was coming. The writing was on the wall when the Trump administration canceled TPS protections for Haitians and Nicaraguans late last year. So the ambassador tells me that her government had been talking with the Trump administration for months, asking for more time for this legislative fix that we just mentioned, and also asking for more time to get their own country ready back at home. So in a sense, I think the government really did see this one final 18-month extension as a victory. But the semantics there are important because the president of El Salvador tweeted something to that effect earlier this week, and it did not go over well. His citizens were angry that he would call it an extension when really the program is just over.
Okay. So you mentioned preparations both in the United States with U.S. lawmakers or attempts in the, in the United States and preparations in El Salvador. I mean, how are they getting ready in El Salvador? Because we're talking about 200,000 people who could go back.
200,000 people going back to a country where 4 in 10 people already live in poverty. It's got one of the worst murder rates in the world. There's rampant gang violence. We just saw this report yesterday from the U.S. government that illegal immigration to the United States is starting to tick back up again. So it's tough there right now. But the ambassador recognizes that and says they're trying to improve. They've got this program. They call it El Salvador es tu casa. El Salvador is your home. And it's a plan to help people who've been living here with TPS to find jobs. And I want to play some of our conversation now where the ambassador says that generally speaking, that groundwork has been paying off. And she said that big picture, migration to the United States has slowed.
In the last year, the people who came to the south border have decreased about 40%. That's the result of our commitment and our engagement in trying to make better conditions for our people.
Well, one of the big concerns I know that people on TPS have is what will they do with their children? As you know, 190,000 of whom were born in the United States and are U.S. citizens. What are parents telling you that they'll do with their children if they have to leave the United States?
They will decide what they can do with their children. We have been telling them on register are their children a Salvadorian citizen also, so they can have options. But we will work for protect the integrity of our children. We know that we have challenges.
But how would they integrate? These are children whose first language may be English and who have grown up only in the United States. How would they do in El Salvador?
You know, El Salvador is their country. We as government are prepared to receive them in this, and we are going to make our best efforts to generate conditions in our country so that in the case that our people decide to leave, they can find spaces in our country.
Do you think that people here in the United States will stay beyond that deadline of September 2019 and go underground? Do you recommend they do that?
You know, that's a decision that they're going to take. You know, we are working to find the support of the Congress so that they can remain here. We need a legal permanent solution for our people.
So, Peter, that's the El Salvadoran ambassador, Claudia Yvette Canjura, speaking to you there. And, you know, I hear in her voice a recognition of the enormous challenges that her nation faces with the ending of TPS here, but also striking a kind of a diplomatic tone as well.
She has to be diplomatic because billions of dollars from the United States, from these workers who were originally from El Salvador, goes back to her country. So there's a lot of political pressure on her and on the government to try to find a legislative solution so that they can stay in the United States and keep working.
Well, so this is really fascinating, Peter, because, of course, as you know, right now, lawmakers are really trying to find a long-term fix for another immigration issue, for the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that protects young people who are brought to this country illegally from deportation. Is there sort of wiggle room there where El Salvador could combine efforts with DACA efforts?
I think the government hopes that there is. You know, there's about 26,000 Salvadorans under DACA here in the U.S. And the ambassador tells me that the U.S. lawmakers who are sympathetic to the DACA cause might also support some of the legislative solutions that are out there for, you know, a long-term fix for TPS. Just yesterday, a Republican from Colorado, Mike Kaufman, he introduced a bill that would grant TPS workers a path to citizenship. But as we've been seeing all week long, the future of DACA is as unclear today as it ever was. And if you just add TPS to that debate, it could be a really heavy lift.
Well, that's Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd speaking to us about his conversation with El Salvador's ambassador to the United States. Peter, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, the Trump administration opened another front today, issuing a letter to states that allows them to impose work requirements on people who receive Medicaid, the biggest change to that program for low-income and frail people in its more than 50-year history. Sarah Cliff, the health policy reporter at Vox, is here. And Sarah, 10 states have been wanting to add work requirements, the way work requirements were added decades ago for welfare payments and food stamps. The Obama administration said no. So remind us further, who is on Medicaid?
So there are about 75 million Americans on Medicaid. It is a very large program. And this particular part, you know, it does cut out some of the populations that are on Medicaid, a good number of pregnant women, disabled, the elderly. But for able-bodied adults, which has about 27 million or so people on Medicaid, this requirement could potentially apply to them.
Well, and we understand, though, that according to Kaiser Health News, 60% of able-bodied people on Medicaid are already working. And of the 40% who remain, many are disabled or caring for young children or in school. So what is it that schools, rather states, want to do?
Yeah, that's a great point that you make, Robin, that people on Medicaid, they are traditionally already working. They're working in low-wage jobs that don't provide health insurance coverage, but most of them are already in a job, which does beg this question of what do states want it to do? And like you said, there are a number of people who are caring for sick relatives, who are in school, who are caring for their own children. So according to the studies I've looked at, we're looking at maybe less than 10% of the population that is on Medicaid and not currently engaged in some sort of activity, whether that's working or caregiving. And these states are looking at that population, essentially. They are saying that if you want to be on Medicaid, we want to encourage you to get a job. It is a very, very different approach than what we've seen in the 50 years of Medicaid's existence. And it focuses on a relatively small segment of Medicaid enrollees that are not currently working.
The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator Seema Varma tweeted out that it was to incentivize community engagement among these able-bodied beneficiaries. But as we've said, it's a smallish number. What's been the, you know, criticism of it?
So the criticism really has to do with some things that are logistic and some things that are fundamental about Medicare. And I'll start with Medicaid. And I'll start with that last one. So there has been, you know, since Medicaid was created, a promise that if you qualify based on your income and certain categories that you fall into, that you would get health coverage, that it would not be conditional on certain actions that you took. This is similar to the Medicare program, where if you turn 65, you qualify for coverage. So it really breaks that fundamental promise that Medicaid has made for 50 years that says if you end up in one of these disadvantaged categories, we are definitely going to give you coverage. Another criticism that's less philosophical, just more logistical, is whether it's worth all the work. As you mentioned, Robin, it's a really small population, and it's going to be a lot of bureaucracy to check if these people are working, to have them submit the paperwork, to have some government official review it. I think there are open questions about how much it will cost a state to run a work requirement, whether that feels worth the investment for what they would be getting out of it.
Well, I was going to say, and so who oversees? So the states would come up with plans, and then someone would have to oversee that. So you, as you say, it's layers of bureaucracy. But in the minute we have, does this have anything to do with the fact that Medicaid was expanded under the Affordable Care Act to people just slightly above the federal poverty level?
It sort of does. So before the Medicaid expansion that was part of the Affordable Care Act, it was usually restricted to the disabled, the pregnant, children, and those people are exempt from the work requirement. The thing that Obamacare did is it extended Obamacare to a lot of able-bodied adults, to people who are low income, right, you know, might be single, but don't have kids. And those are the people who would be hit by this requirement. They gained Medicaid a few years ago. Most of them, like I said earlier, they're already working. But those that aren't, they are the ones who could stand to lose coverage, these new recipients of Medicaid who are part of the Affordable Care Act.
That's Sarah Cliff, health policy reporter at Vox, as states today got the letter from the Trump administration saying that they can have a work mandate for Medicaid recipients. Sarah, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump is facing another deadline tomorrow on the Iran nuclear deal. He's also being challenged by one of America's top allies. British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson said today that President Trump needs to show there is a better alternative to the deal that limits its nuclear program before it's scrapped altogether. That's Iran's nuclear program. Johnson spoke in Brussels after talks with Iran's foreign minister and European diplomats.
I don't think anybody has come up with a better idea. I mean, I think it's incumbent on those who oppose the JCPOA really to come up with that better solution, because we haven't seen it so far. I also think that if we can keep the deal going, which I very much hope that we can, that the Iranian people should see the economic benefits that will flow from the JCPOA.
The JCPOA is the acronym for the Iran nuclear deal. Back in October, President Trump refused to recertify that Iran was complying with the agreement. By tomorrow, he's supposed to decide whether to extend relief for Iran from some U.S. economic sanctions. Those sanctions, which were suspended in 2016, cut Iran's central bank out of the international financial system and imposed penalties for buying Ukrainian oil.
There are war zones all over the world, and we always think it's remarkable that people rush to them to volunteer to help civilians caught in the crossfire. Dr. John Kaler, a pediatrician from Chicago, is one of them. He co-founded MedGlobal, which works with local healthcare providers and non-governmental agencies in medical missions around the world: Syria, Yemen, Bangladesh, Haiti, Puerto Rico. Dr. Kaler came to our attention in a powerful CNN report from Clarissa Ward. She visited a hospital in Yemen where Dr. Kaler was assisting a staff struggling to treat patients. Here he's in the neonatal ward.
So in addition to be preemie, these babies are jaundiced.
Jaundiced.
Right. And so they're going to get phototherapy. At this point in time, even if we got more beds here to fill the numbers of patients, we don't have the staff.
Clarissa also introduced us to a little boy who came to the hospital very sick, a lung infection, and later died. That's not always the outcome, of course, but it put in stark relief how challenging providing medical care in a war zone is. So how and why does he do it? Dr. John Kaler joins us now from WBEZ in Chicago. Dr. Kaler, welcome, and we have to say thank you for your work.
Well, you're very welcome. The work is work of my heart, and I really appreciate you acknowledging it.
Well, to talk about Yemen, for instance, you told Clarissa about some of the conditions there. What are people missing?
Well, it's the second time that MedGlobal has been to Yemen in the past 6 months. The first time was a couple of months ago when we were up further north in an area very close to the fighting in Sana'a called Marib. And in that location, the town, which had been a major source of oil revenue in the past, had tripled its population in a matter of a year and a half with internally displaced personnel from Sana'a. So as you might imagine, their healthcare facilities were overwhelmed with patients to the point where The major teaching hospital there actually had to shut the pediatric facility down because there were so many war wounded and adults displaced.
Well, you didn't even have soap.
No, and none of these areas are the most basic of needs met. In the South, the place where I met Clarissa Ward, we were at a hospital, a pediatric hospital, a wonderful hospital. The name of the hospital is Sadaka, which translates to charity, essentially giving good charity. And it was in Aden, and Aden is currently far away from the fighting. It serves as a capital now that the facilities have moved from Sana'a. So this was a 300-bed children's hospital that was completely overwhelmed with patients in need and underserved with the most basic of resources, such as soap, beds. Three children, I was in the intensive care unit or in the neonatal intensive care unit, and you might know what phototherapy is. It's when babies get jaundiced at birth and they treat them for X hours and they go home happily. Well, there were four babies in one crib receiving phototherapy, which is normally reserved to, one baby per phototherapy unit. They had a nursery that was supposed to serve 35 newborns, and they had 70 there when I was there. It's a heart-wrenching situation.
Yeah. Look, you talk about them being in Syria, in Aleppo. Of course, the devastation there, barrel bombs.
Yeah.
And so what are some of the wounds that children come in with?
So we were in Aleppo. We were probably the last, two colleagues and myself, were probably the last Western physicians that were able to be in there just before the siege was closed over in July of 16. And so what would happen, the Assad regime would do two things. They would drop a barrel bomb, which is essentially exactly what it sounds like. It's a barrel filled with dynamite and things like that. And it would blow up. It would blow up and devastate a local area. They'd drop it into a local community. And then what would happen? Drop it from a helicopter. And so all of the types of wounds you could imagine if kids were out, so if it was dropped around the time of a market or something like that, you would have terrible head wounds. You would have terrible wounds to the abdomen, to limbs, things that would you can think about as concussive wounds and shrapnel wounds in the immediacy. But what would happen is if the kids were in, say, inside a building and the bomb was dropped close enough to the building, it would blow walls out, blow windows out. And so what you would get then would be all the trauma associated with secondary shrapnel, dust and pellets and things like that. And so you'd get a lot of superficial head wounds, a lot of more superficial wounds, but you'd also get things like eye wounds, ear wounds, things that are extremely hard to deal with in any place.
And you get trauma. You talk about what's the 1,000-yard stare?
Well, 1,000-yard stare. If you remember the picture of that little boy in the back of a ambulance in orange.
Yeah.
And you see him sitting there with the blood. Well, what you literally see, not from so much from the picture, but from the video that goes with it, you see a child who you know is seeing but not comprehending. Mm. So his vision has not been blinded, but he is essentially closed off. It's what happens under extreme trauma. The senses close down to the point where the only way the body, and more particularly in this situation, the mind can tolerate it is to essentially close off. This is what in World War I they called
shell shock.
Shell shock, yes, yeah. Exactly. And shell shock and post-traumatic stress, and it's things like that.
So you have a rash of children attempting suicide?
Well, there are children attempting suicide. There's two big worries in war zones. So in a place like Yemen where famine, it's much more so bullets and bombs aren't killing as many people in Yemen as starvation is, as cholera is, as infectious disease are. We just came up to a situation where diphtheria was killing, but it killed three children while close to when we were there. And diphtheria is not something most physicians – I'm old enough to have seen a case here in the States. But they're dealing with tens of them in Yemen, and we have a clinic that we set up to serve the Rohingya in Bangladesh.
the refugees.
And there's been hundreds of cases in Bangladesh of diphtheria. In back in Yemen, where famine is at, cholera has been the largest cholera outbreak in history ever recorded. Over a million people have had cholera. Luckily, the Vibrio, the germ that causes the cholera, isn't real dangerous this time, but there's still been 3 to 5% death rate, which is a significant amount.
Yeah. So how do you do this? I can hear the Chicago in you. And, you know, how do you come home to Chicago having seen this? What do you do with this?
Well, I get asked that question a lot, and I'm blessed to have 6 wonderful children, 12 equally wonderful grandchildren. And one of the things that makes me comfortable is that there's a feeling that as I give, so would someone else give if my children and grandchildren needed it. So I'm able to say what I've done may be small. It certainly may not be a lot, but it made some use. It made some help. And I'm able to deal psychologically with that, knowing that although I couldn't have helped everybody, I certainly helped somebody.
It's just so admirable. And yet you wonder, you just mentioned 6 children and 12 grandchildren. Do you ever think, for their sake, maybe don't go into a war zone anymore?
Don't think that at all. I think actually the children all grown and done well. The grandchildren have wonderful parents. It's much better for me to do this than for younger people to do it. Younger people still have that part of their life to live. If something, God forbid, were to happen to me, I've been through that part of my life. This is legacy time for me. So, no, I don't think that.
That is Dr. John Kaler, co-founder of Med Global. Dr. Kaler, thank you and best to you.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the attention for the organization and for the needs of these very, very needy children. Thank you very much.
I'm Robin Young, co-host with Jeremy Hobson of Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. We cover the day's most essential news with analysis and context so you know the why and the what's next. Plus authors, artists, people making a difference. It's a fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Walmart, the largest private employer in the country, has announced it will raise its starting wages to $11 an hour. The company will also offer bonuses up to $1,000 to many of its workers and expand paid parental leave. Walmart president and CEO Doug McMillon said in a statement that, quote, we are early in the stages of assessing the opportunities tax reform creates for us to invest in our customers and associates and to further strengthen our business, all of which should benefit our shareholders, end quote. So let's take a closer look at this with Jill Schlesinger. She's business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. And Jill, just to play off the name of your podcast, this announcement is good for Walmart workers. They'll be better off with the wage increase, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's going to affect about 1 million of their workers, so it's not nothing, but I think this is really a little bit more about the competition for workers than about these tax cuts. You know, remember, unemployment rate, it's at a 17-year low. And last year, I know it's really weird to imagine this. It was a very good year for job creation, but the retail industry lost over 60,000 jobs in 2017. But a lot of those workers have been scooped up by Amazon and other online retailers. And that means that really the trend is for competition. It's also a continuation right now of some other moves for Walmart. It's the third U.S.-wide minimum wage increase at the company since 2015.
Right. So they had increased it to $9 and then $10, and now they're saying $11.
Correct.
About that sort of competition in the retail market, I'm remembering that last fall, I think it was, Target raised its minimal hourly wage to $11, and they announced that they're going to eventually do it to $15. So, you know, beyond Amazon, just its other brick-and-mortar competitor, Target's really pushing the envelope there.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned Target. They've got 300,000 employees. And as you say, they're pledging to go up to 15. Costco, Gap, You know, I think that the reality is that the labor market has really moved in a very different direction. I also would point out that the competition is not just about any worker. It's for qualified workers because it costs a lot of money for a company to invest in hiring someone. They've got to train that person, so they want to retain them. So they're looking for good people who want to make a career at Walmart.
Well, you know, you said that it may be more about those things than about the tax cut, but the GOP and President Trump have said that this is exactly the kind of result that they want to see from the tax cut. So maybe it was just enough incentive to push Walmart to spend. I'm seeing something like $300 to $700 million to raise these wages.
Yeah, I mean, okay, but the company already made $500 billion in global revenue last year. So and they are going to give billions in savings from the tax overhaul. But let's just do that. It's a B. Billions.
Yeah.
And we're talking about millions. And look, if you're someone who is making nine and you're going up to 11, that's awesome. But I don't want to fall into the trap and say, like, oh, aren't they so generous? Because clearly the move of the tax cuts is much more likely to impact shareholders' bottom line rather than the workers' bottom line.
Okay, Jill, I was about to call you Eeyore, but I take your point here. We got
hey, wait a minute, I'm called Tigger. Come on now.
We got 15 seconds here, though. Walmart's a huge player. Could other companies follow suit?
Yes, but I mean, I think that that's more, again, about the labor market competition. Good news for workers. Let's get those wages up. It's actually good news for the economy long term if that is sustainable.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money and the podcast Better Off. Thank you, as always, Jill/Tigger.
Take care.
New York City is suing five major oil companies, claiming that those companies are responsible for damages related to climate change. At the same time, the city's two biggest pension funds are moving to divest from fossil fuels. Democratic Mayor Bill de Blasio made those announcements yesterday. He joins us now. And Mayor de Blasio, New York is suing BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Royal Dutch Shell. So what exactly are you arguing?
It's really simple. They are some of the very biggest companies in the fossil fuel industry. That industry knowingly exacerbated climate change. They had all the evidence in the world of the damage that their products were causing, and they continued nonetheless to poison the earth. And we're saying simply that this city, which suffered so deeply after Hurricane Sandy, has literally experienced billions and billions of dollars of damage as a result of climate change that these specific companies aided and abetted. And they should pay damages for that, very much the same way that tobacco companies were forced to pay damages for the horrible impact that they had knowingly on public health for so many years.
Now, you're seeking damages, as you said, because of infrastructure costs that climate change has wrought on New York. I mean, what's the dollar value of the damages you're seeking?
We don't have a specific dollar figure we're looking for at this point. Any outcome would have to be in the billions to be a serious one. What we know right now is, for example, to try to protect our city going forward from climate change, we're in the middle of a $20 billion resiliency initiative right this minute. We know when that money is spent, we'll need a lot more. And so the goal is to not repeat the mistakes of the past, to hold these companies accountable and make them pay for the solutions going forward. And so unquestionably in the billions, but it's a number that would have to be determined by a court.
So, Mayor de Blasio, I mean, to your point about some of the oil companies knowing about the effects of climate change, just to remind folks, there's been a lot of coverage about the fact that ExxonMobil, for example, some 40 years ago knew about fossil fuels and climate change. They had the research. They didn't tell the public. And in fact, they spent millions of dollars to promote some misinformation about that. There's been good reporting on that. But on the other hand, I have to say, climate change is such a complicated phenomenon. Why aren't you also suing, I don't know, China for its use of fossil fuels, India? Why aren't you suing the Trump administration for pulling out of the Paris Accord? Why aren't you suing former members of the U.S. government for its 50-plus years of pro-fossil fuel policies? I mean, for that matter, why aren't you suing Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Niger, every country that gives us fossil fuels? I mean, you see my point? Like, a lot of people might see this as more of a political stunt than anything else.
Magna, there are many countries and companies that bear responsibility here, but here's what we know. These are amongst the leading actors by any estimation. These multinational fossil fuel companies have led the way. They often were the ones that dictated government policies around the world to allow them to do what they were doing to for their own profit. So let's be clear. I don't think anyone who is looking for fundamental change on this issue would fail to note that the biggest international petroleum companies are the core of the problem. We are suing them because we believe we can successfully sue them. We believe that we can get real damages here that will help protect the people in New York City going forward and will also affect the behavior of these companies. If they are finally held accountable for what they've done, it will affect their bottom line and their choices going forward. And again, we have a perfect model in the tobacco lawsuits. At the outset, one could argue there were many, many elements of government and society that were aiding and abetting tobacco use, but the core of the problem was the tobacco companies themselves, who were really calling the tune. Those lawsuits ultimately prevailed, and a huge amount of money went into addressing the public health impact of tobacco. We want to follow that same path, help to end climate change impacts by these companies by changing their behavior and get money back for the people of this city.
Yeah. Mr. Mayor, I'm going to talk with you about the pension funds in just a second, but I got to ask. I mean, you've mentioned tobacco a couple of times. Many people might see that, yes, as a relevant comparison, but we're talking about the tobacco companies and, you know, that they knowingly created an addictive product. Whereas for the fossil fuel companies, they were selling a product that the world's economies couldn't function without. I mean, is that a kind of addiction? I can't imagine modern life without fossil fuels up until this date.
Look, at a certain point in our history, our economy got built on fossil fuels without an understanding of the impact on climate change. But over time, these companies did come to understand it. They saw the science. There's plenty of evidence that they knew about it. They discussed it internally, and they went to a great deal of trouble to cover up that information and deny it. That's another strong parallel here. We know the very cynical actions of the tobacco companies 40, 50 years ago when they already knew that tobacco caused cancer, and yet they covered up the information and spun it as a perfectly healthy form of entertainment. Here's the parallel. It's once upon a time, you may have argued, the fossil fuel industries didn't know, but once they did understand the horrible damage that was being caused, they went out of their way to try to cover up that information and to try to present the notion that their work was not hurting the earth. It was systematic, and they went out of their way to ensure that people kept using petroleum products in ever-growing numbers. They did not say, we need to get out of this horrible, damaging work right away. We need to move to other endeavors. They continued and tried to justify their efforts. And look, the proof is in what happened in this city and so many other coastal areas in this country that have had devastating impacts from natural disasters caused by climate change. We don't have a federal government that's coming to our aid right now in any appreciable level. We're trying to go right at the original authors of the problem, who are these big multinational oil companies.
Yeah. Mr. Mayor, I appreciate you engaging with me on this issue of the lawsuit, but I do want to also give you a chance to tell us about another action that the city is taking regarding oil companies, because New York's two largest pension funds, the New York City Employees Retirement System and the Teachers Retirement System, have announced that they're going to divest their funds of $5 billion in fossil fuel investments. Why do that now?
Because we have to change the reality in our society, first of all. The power of the divestment movement is it says that this is no longer going to be accepted as the normal course of things to continue to invest in something that's poisoning the earth, exacerbating natural disasters, and by the way, is not even a smart investment for the future. You know, there are many estimates that say the vast majority of fossil fuel resources will never be taken out of the earth because it's become too dangerous and too damaging to the environment. So why invest in an industry whose fundamental assets will never be utilized? We think there are better, smarter investments, more forward-looking investments. I'm very proud to say New York City was in the forefront, ending investments in South Africa during the apartheid regime, ending investments in private prisons, ending investments in the coal industry. It's quite clear that it is smart both fiscally and morally to stop investing in fossil fuel industries. And by taking $5 billion of investments away, It sends a very powerful message to those industries. It also shows if you can do that in the financial capital of the earth, other states, other cities can do it. No state, no city has ever taken such a definitive action. $5 billion will be taken out of those investments. We will end those investments once and for all over the next few years. This sends a signal that the whole investment reality is going to change for these companies, and they need to change their business model accordingly.
So last question to you about this, because as you obviously know, Governor Andrew Cuomo has pushed for the state to follow suit, but New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli said last month that he doesn't really want the state pension funds to do that, because basically he says that he thinks the best way to address climate change is for these pensions, which are really big, heavy hitters with these companies in terms of the numbers of shares they own, to be more of activist shareholders. But if you divest, you lose your seat at the table. What do you make of his argument?
I understand the argument, but unfortunately, I think it's been disproven over time when it comes to this particular industry. We know that the fossil fuel industry has been resistant to change. And again, we know that they long ago understood the impact they were having on global warming and continued to do what they were doing. I don't think shareholder activism changes multinational corporations of the scale of ExxonMobil or Shell or Chevron. I think they need to see that the fundamental economics are going to change and that more and more investors are going to walk away from them. I think, look, you have to vote with your feet sometimes. It's important for these companies to understand that they will not be able to pull together the kind of investment they used to, because more and more governments certainly believe it is a mistaken investment and it's not even smart fiscally going forward.
Well, that's New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Mayor de Blasio, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so very much.
Thank you. Be well.
Inside the walls of prison, my body may be, but my Lord has set my soul free.
Johnny Cash first performed this song, Greystone Chapel, as part of his legendary recording session at Folsom Prison near Sacramento, California, 50 years ago Saturday. That was also the day the famous country singer met the song's author, inmate Glenn Shirley. As Chloe Veltman from member station KQED reports, the fateful encounter was to change both men's lives, for better and for worse.
The night before Johnny Cash's appearance at Folsom, a prison minister handed him a recording of inmate Glenn Shirley's song, inspired by the penitentiary's imposing granite chapel. Gene Bealey, then a young reporter, was at the scene.
John says, well, anybody got a tape recorder? So I raised my hand, and we put this little demo tape on there, and it was Greystone Chapel by Glenn Shirley. He says, I want to record this tomorrow.
Bealey says Cash copied down the lyrics in his hotel room and started working up the song. Bealey caught the rehearsal on tape.
Inside the walls of prison, my body may be.
The next morning, Cash and his entourage headed out to record what would become one of the most influential albums of the 20th century, Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison. Glenn Shirley had a front row seat in the prison's drab cafeteria for the show. The convict was doing time for armed robbery, and he had no idea that Cash had gotten hold of his song.
This song was written by our friend Glenn Shirley. And hope we do your song justice, Glenn. We're going to do our best.
Cash performed many prison concerts during his career, including four dates at Folsom. But the 1968 gig helped to relaunch the singer's career, which was floundering at the time in a drug-addled haze. It also boosted Cash's ongoing campaign for prison reform. That's an issue which his daughter, Tara Cash Schwebel, says her father held dear.
I think it really spoke to his rebellious side. He really had a passion for standing up for these people who were locked up, you know, and treated so poorly.
Cash and Shirley hit it off. A lifelong Christian who believed strongly in redemption, Cash did a lot to get his new friend on the right path. He helped Shirley cut his own album. In 1971, he lobbied successfully to get the handsome inmate paroled and gave him a job as a performer with his band. Shirley tried to adjust to his new life on the outside. He joined Cash's crusade for prison reform, got married, and adopted a son. Keith Shirley remembers his dad fondly.
My dad had a great laugh and a great smile. We did a lot of things together, and he was fun.
But the budding rock star found it hard to cope with being thrust under the spotlight after years in prison. Keith Shirley says his dad was battling drug addiction and wasn't easy to live with.
There was a lot of domestic trouble between he and my mom.
The issues bled into his professional life. Tara Cash-Schwebel says Shirley's behavior became erratic.
My father realized that, you know, it was time to kind of break the ties with him.
Cash kicked Shirley out of the band, and his life spiraled out of control. In 1978, he killed himself. He was 42. Schwebel says her father was devastated.
It was a wake-up call that he realized he couldn't save everybody.
On the day Cash heard the news about Shirley's suicide, his son Keith says the singer drew a picture in his journal of a bird flying away from a prison cell window.
And beneath it he wrote the caption, "The Lord has set my soul free."
These are words from Greystone Chapel, the song that first brought the two men together.
A house of worship in this den of sin.
For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Veltzman in San Francisco.
God had a place here at Folsom.
What a backstory. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.